Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring. Ring with the harmony of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening sky. Let it resound.
Lift every voice and sing. This is rendition sung by Sister Marie Knight. Written, of course, as we said earlier, James Bolton Johnson, the Negro National Anthem. This is not, today is not, but we celebrate every year. I think it's been 10 years that we've been doing this on the air, Homeless Persons Memorial Day. It will be on December 21st. We will read the names, talk about homelessness, about how we end homelessness in the society. We are joined here in the studio by Kevin Lindemood, who is President and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless since 2011, began his career there as an outreach worker almost 20 years ago. Lynn Romano is with us, COO of the Govan's Ecumenical Development Corporation. Tony Simmons is with us once again, housing advocate at Housing Our Neighbors, writer for Word on the Street. The Reverend Dennis Dorsch is with us, retired United Methodist minister who remains actively involved with the United Methodist Church, active member of Baltimore United Congregations, and SHARP, local coalitions of service providers, faith communities, individuals working to raise consciousness about the structural solutions to homelessness. And folks, welcome. Good to have all of you in our studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
410-319-8888 is the number here. You can write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. Log on to our Facebook pages. Tweet us at Mark Steiner as we talk about homelessness in our community, as celebrates a hard way to put it, but Homeless Persons Memorial Day coming up this Saturday, December the 21st. We talk about homelessness a lot, and you see all these articles going back and forth about homelessness in our society, people saying it's less than it ever was, it's going down, it's not the issue it was, and everybody has kind of a strange smirk on their face in this room. To that response, Kevin?
Rumors of the demise of homelessness, Mark, are greatly exaggerated. It's, of course, all how one defines the problem and counts the number of our neighbors experiencing it. Without question, as a symptom of poverty, homelessness is higher than it ever was. More of our neighbors, men, women, children, entire families, finding themselves without a regular place to stay. On Homeless Persons Memorial Day, December 21st, it's the first day of winter, the longest night of the year. We take a moment as a community to pause and remember our homeless neighbors, remember that these individuals had lives with meaning and purpose, and that the deaths that we commemorate each and every year, we've been doing this show with you, Mark, for 10 years.
Right.
There will be 100 people close to it that you will read 95 names. By the time Saturday rolls around, that list will be closer to 100. There were more than 100 last year, around the same the year before. These are preventable deaths. People experiencing homelessness are 3 to 4 times more likely than their house counterparts to die prematurely, due primarily to the presence of acute and chronic health problems and the lack of access to comprehensive health care. We can change this. We remember the words of Mother Jones, right, to pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. While it's important that we pause to remember those who lived, at the same time, we have to recommit ourselves as a community to defining the problem appropriately and implementing the public policy solutions to make homelessness rare and brief.
Because, Tony, it's always good to have you with us.
It's good to be here, Mark.
And, you know, as someone who's been through this himself and is one of the leading activists from the street out to end homelessness, I mean, it has to be sometimes frustrating to come up against this day after day, year after year.
Yeah, you get that feeling of being helpless that you can't do anything about it. But like Kevin said, you know, you got to fight. I lost a really good friend beginning of the year named Dana, and the feeling of being helpless. I'm watching this whole event unfold in front of my eyes. I'm watching his life slip from his body, but that feeling of being helpless that you can't do anything about it, and it's day in and day out, and you may have 95 names now, but there's way far more, because it's hard to, when I'm on a committee to help gather names, and it's very difficult getting these names because all the places that you have to get names from. But I walk the street and they'll tell me, well, did you hear about Charles or you heard about Susan? And I'm like, well, who were they? Because normally all you know is their nicknames or their first name or something they call them by. And I would say 95, 100, that's way too many. One is too many in my eyes, and we need to do something about that.
Let me probe this a bit further, Tony. What you just said, I think people don't have a sense of what you're describing here. You're talking about having to pull together, find out who people were, who died, what their names were. I mean, talk a bit about that. That's a very tough job emotionally.
Yes, indeed.
But B, what you have to go through to find out, the idea you have to find out who people really were.
Yeah, you find out who they were. These people had lives, and seem like they're forgotten ones. And you walk the street, and you're like, what happened to this person? I don't see him anymore. Or what happened to her? I don't see her anymore. And it comes into the back of my mind, are they lying somewhere? Have they died? Have they passed away? That we just don't know about it? And these are my friends. These are my family out here. When I'm on the street, I'm looking for them, and I'm hoping that when I go here or there that this individuals will be there. But this weather, when it gets really, really cold, this is when I worry the most. This is where most advocates worry the most, when the weather gets really, really cold. So many people can die from hypothermia, pneumonia, and different things like that. So it's a tough job, especially trying to gather the names, because each one you find, it just takes a little piece out of you every time.
And just the whole process of finding the names themselves has to take a piece.
Yes, indeed, every time.
Dennis, I mean, this is, you know, as a minister, you've been active in this for a long time, and is it hard to draw these connections between, especially parishioners of means who don't quite get what goes on and the reality of what happens to the poorest among us?
I think it's hard to draw the connection for anybody who is comfortable with those people who are extremely uncomfortable. But every faith community, all of the major faiths of the world, speak out against homelessness and call upon their people to work to help the homeless and to take them in. Islam in the Quran commends and orders people to receive the homeless into their own homes. The Jewish tradition is replete with references to the responsibility of the person of God to feed the hungry, to clothe the naked, and to provide a home for those who are homeless. Buddhism talks about karma, the personal responsibility, and the responsibility of compassion to reach out and care for those who are hungry and homeless. And Christianity picks up on those Jewish roots, and Jesus is emphatic that if you do not care for those who are hungry or naked or homeless, that you are denying him what he needs. So the message is there. The message is crystal clear, but we become so comfortable in our lives that we begin to blame those people who are not living at our level. We think there must be something wrong with them, because if I can do it, why can't they do it? And we forget that in each of these faith traditions, their God is saying to them, you're only able to do this because I have chosen to bless you, and I have given you the opportunities, and you have not suffered the difficulties that some other people are suffering. So that it's a connection problem, and the disparity in our country between the upper levels of wealth and the lower levels of wealth is growing so greatly.
Yes.
that it's amazing. In 2002, or since 2002, in New York City, homelessness has increased some 69%.
And we look at New York City, I've seen those articles come out of the New York Times, and in Lynn Romano, I mean, that's one of the things that we keep hearing it's less in Baltimore, but it's counterintuitive. How do we really know? Who's telling us these things? What do we know and don't know?
There's a very interesting way of counting people who are homeless, picking one night in January where most people are holed up and very difficult to find. So if you're not in a shelter or in a visible location out in the city, you're not going to be counted. We do see the numbers going down in that official count, yet it belies all of our own experiences. Broke my heart last night. I was leaving Healthcare for the Homeless after working on memorializing people in signs that we're going to be carrying with us on Saturday.
People's names on signs.
People's names of those who have passed away. And you walk out the door, and there are people who, for whatever reason, cannot access shelter, who are sitting out there all night long, just waiting for a little bit of warmth the next day, with a shelter a block away that is not open to them, whether they've been barred from it, whether their physical or mental health status doesn't allow them to stay there. We see these people who are homeless. And we know that there's a tremendous number of faith communities trying to respond to that. GEDCO has 53 member organizations, a lot of interfaith effort directed towards this problem, and it's not enough. Every night, I go to bed, you know, snuggle in my nice warm bed, and think about people who are still out there and wondering, will there be a place for me? Will I die tonight? And I'm wondering, am I doing enough? And the answer is always no. None of us are doing enough as long as one of our brothers or sisters are out there.
And people don't think of people as our brothers and sisters because it's so separate as because we do. I mean, it's easy not to see people or to think of them as a blight, or why is this person on the corner begging me for money, or it's the other. It can't happen to me. It's too far away from who we are. That is like it happens all the time, and we just don't see it. We don't realize how many of us are just months away from having nothing.
I think
how quickly it can happen.
I think it's a defense mechanism, the us versus them. And yet when we realize, as Reverend Dorsch was saying, the gap between the very rich and the very, very poor is only increasing, and in fact the majority of us are falling into the lower part of that spread, we're talking about us and us in many cases. To Lynn's point about the difficulty of getting an actual count and how these counts are really conducted and derived, there are methodological problems and definitions that make drawing any conclusions from the Baltimore numbers or the national numbers spurious at best. One just can't make the kind of claims that are being made by HUD on a national level, Department of Housing and Urban Development, and other organizations who claim that homelessness is actually decreasing. The counts that Lynn was talking about only include people physically on the streets in shelter. They do not define as homeless, though others of us do, those who are doubling up with friends, neighbors, and relatives, living transiently from place to place. And yet we know that the doubled-up population is at an all-time high of people that can't afford a place to stay and are moving in order to prevent actually being on the streets. So the numbers, without question, just as the numbers of people living in poverty are on the rise.
And as our unemployment benefits now are being cut for people, we're going to see a further rise in homelessness.
Right.
At the same time that the stimulus money that helped provide short-term relief for people who are being evicted is also going away.
I mean, we're seeing maybe it's 2 or 2.5% of the unemployed in America are chronically unemployed, have been unemployed for a long time. Congress has just voted in the latest budget deals, what you're alluding to end those benefits. So the people after the end of this year will no longer receive unemployment benefits, which means that will add to the homeless rolls, add to the number of families who are at in churches and other places getting food for lunch and dinner for their children, for their whole families. And you're going to see more of that. You're seeing more and more children with their families being homeless. As there are homeless kids that we don't talk about in this community as well.
Right. A family earning the federal minimum wage mark of $7.25 an hour cannot afford market rate housing in any jurisdiction in the country. And that is striking, and that is something that we have to change.
We have a tweet coming in. Reverend Meredith writes in on a tweet, tweeted us this morning. Building casinos in Harbor Point won't solve homelessness. BMOR needs better mental health services and affordable housing. So let's wrestle with this for just a minute. You know, this is one of the big – rhetorically, we hear this a lot and the other side a lot saying that you have to have casinos for revenue and you have to have Harbor Point to bring in business and bring in people to Baltimore who will pay taxes and build the city. You can't develop a city without it. But people are saying, well, if you do that, does that mean you don't do mental health services? Is there a contradiction here? Do we not do Harbor Point? Do you not build a casino? Is that what it takes to build ensure housing for everybody? Or are there other ways to do that? I mean, that is, I think, part of the crux of an economic discussion about the city that we have to have. We're going to break now? 1 minute. Okay, who wants to take us here? Literally 1 minute, 60 seconds to tease us into that idea.
Well, it's based on an assumption, Mark, that a rising economic tide lifts all boats. Right? You invest in your city, you bring more people back in, your tax base goes up and it lifts all boats. We've got decades of evidence that suggests that that's just faulty thinking. We have to purposefully direct resources toward the most vulnerable to lift up those boats so that they can participate in the broader society like the rest of us.
Even building our stadiums, where we talked about that being an economic boost, created some very low-wage jobs for some people.
Some very low-wage jobs. We talked to those workers in the very beginning. We're going to have a brief break and come back as we continue remembering the homeless here today as we work our way towards Homeless Persons Memorial Day. As we go to break, we're going to hear Come See About Me, Supremes. This was their number one hit in 1964 on this day. Professor Longhair, one of the fathers of the New Orleans sound, Big Chief, the Indians of New Orleans, Mardi Gras. Professor Longhair was born this day in 1918, one of my favorites, a classic. So part of this day in history. We are talking about another part of our history that we're trying to end, which is called homelessness. This Saturday is Homeless Persons Memorial Day. This Saturday, December the 21st, and we are here with Kevin Lindemood, President and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless. Since 2011, he's been there for 20 years. He started as an outreach worker, has seen from the streets to where he is now, and has been working in this, dedicated his life, as did his predecessor, Jeff Singer, at Healthcare for the Homeless. Lynn Romano is with us, COO of Govan's Ecumenical Development Corporation. Tony Simmons is with us, a housing advocate for housing at Housing Our Neighbors, and a writer for Word on the Street, who has experienced homelessness and is a ferocious fighter to end homelessness and as a voice for the people of the streets. The Reverend Dennis Dorsch, retired United Methodist minister, who has been actively fighting to end homelessness in this society his whole life. You all can join us here at 410-319-8888. Your thoughts on homelessness in our community, write to us at steinershow@gmail.com. You can tweet us at Mark Steiner, as Meredith just did. You can also log on to our Facebook page, which I'm going to check, 410-319-8888. Let's go to the phones, because the question we raised at the end about other contradiction between ending homelessness, providing services and housing for every citizen of our community, a contradiction with developing the rest of our community. Can they go together? Does one have to be sacrificed for the other? We have a comment from a listener just on that. We'll hear what our guests have to say as well. 410-319-8888. Russ, you're on the air.
Greetings, Mark.
Hi, Russ. Welcome. Guests. Welcome.
You know, Mark, one of the things that riled me so much about Harbor East was that they extended the poverty line down to Sales Point to include $88 million for completion of that project that came out of poverty money, as I understand it.
That's correct.
And what I'm saying is, if a developer wants to come into a city like Baltimore, a harborfront city, all the amenities that we have, why don't we say to them, okay, you want to do this project, fine, well, and good. But we want to couple that with a project where you do something to help us alleviate other problems, our homelessness, our poverty, and so forth. I think they can go together, and you can have linkage there where you just ask the people with the money who wants to come in and make more money to do something for the people who don't. That's a question of leadership.
That, Russ, I think that's a really powerful thought. Outside of most people think when it comes to what we're supposed to do. The people are already supposed to, Kevin. People are already supposed to. There's a law in the book saying that 10% of the houses you build, any development, have to go to moderate income housing. Did I say that? Moderate income housing? That's what I'm trying to say. Moderately priced housing. No one's been forced to do that since, let alone your idea of saying you're going to build this thing downtown. You need to do something to couple that.
Yes, there's absolutely no teeth in the inclusionary housing law that you
thank
mentioned.
You for saying, I couldn't get the word out of my head.
Right. and in fact, no new housing has been constructed that's affordable because of it. And the point that the caller's making, I think, is right on point. There's not an invisible hand of the market that's going to do this naturally. We have to very deliberately reach out and create public policies that lift up our most vulnerable neighbors. We have to remember, I was giving a lecture recently to a class at Hopkins, and it occurred to me, I asked for a show of hands, not a single person in the room had been born before 1990, I think. And it was striking. It was Dr. Peter Bielenson's class. We were the only two people in the room that were born before a time when contemporary homelessness was just a ubiquitous experience on the American landscape. We have to remember that contemporary homelessness is relatively recent.
That's an important point.
Seen since the Great Depression.
Right.
We can institute policies and programs to make homelessness rare and brief. We have to do it deliberately as a society. We have to reflect it in our policies.
That's incredibly important. Modern homelessness is a product of the 1980s.
Late 70s and 1980s, due to disinvestment in housing, due to lack of availability of health care, and due to the declining value of the minimum wage that we've been talking about.
There's a very solvable primary reason people are homeless: lack of housing. A lack of affordable housing, and we need to devote more resources to solving that problem, which in turn will move people off of the streets. We also need the ancillary services, the health care, the case management, the help up. When we talk about bringing a tax base back to Baltimore, people who are homeless aren't automatically not part of that. Once they have housing, many people are able to return to work and return to being people who pay taxes into the city. Somehow we're afraid to look at them as something other than people with a long-term dependency.
Dennis, and then we'll go back to the phones.
The National Housing Trust Fund was established in, I think it was 2004, to provide low-income housing in major centers around the country. Except Congress and the administration forgot to provide any funding to do that housing.
That's a great point.
They have the plan in place, but no money. And there's a proposal now before Congress to reduce the housing tax credit on houses that are worth $1 million or more by, I think it's 2%. And you're not having any success in getting Congress people to sign on to that, you know, even though it doesn't. It's hardly a blip on the screen for those people that it would affect. And yet it would produce all of that income to provide the housing without raising anybody else's taxes. You know?
Right.
But we don't want to do that. You mentioned trickle-down economics. One of my favorite economists right now is Pope Francis, who in his encyclical just pointed out that trickle-down economics does not work. It has never worked. And he's talking as a man who has been at the down part for most of his life of service. He's seen that it doesn't get down there. And it just doesn't happen that way. You have to take 1%, 2%, 3% of that $88 million that you give to Harbor Point and pull that off to do something with housing and do something with the people who are in need, provide health care. And I expect that that contractor and that developer is going to still develop Harbor Point, even if they only got $87 million instead of $88
million. I just wanted to mention the National Housing Trust Fund that Dennis mentioned has been passed but not funded. Our own Mayor Stephanie Rawlings-Blake, has recently endorsed the funding, the campaign that would result in the funding of the National Housing Trust Fund. So I encourage listeners to call your member of Congress, mention the National Housing Trust Fund. It's very important that we fund that vehicle. That's one way to try to create a national reinvestment in housing that's affordable to very low-income people.
Well, I won't mention, I guess I should not mention, the representative who in October, before a group of us, advocated that he was completely in support of this new funding plan, but he still hasn't signed on to the bill.
You can mention his name if you want to. I don't care.
Well, it's Brother Cummings, who does many good things, but, we need him to step up on that, and we need all of the others to do the same thing and follow his leadership.
I think there's a lot there, but we won't get into all the politics now, maybe a little bit of it. Before we go back to the phones, you want to jump in with a word here on this, Tony?
Oh, yeah. I don't mind Harbor Point, so I don't mind Harbor East. I can't afford to go down there, but I don't mind them building it. But are we building these things on the backs of the people? If you go east or north of Harbor Point, you're right back into a really poor neighborhood down Lower Fells Point, Broadway area. You got the Perkins Projects right there. And when we travel through that neighborhood, we're looking around and going, what about us? You see all these big high-rises and all these big glorious-looking buildings going up, but you're still saying, what about us? You know, are you building these large companies and these beautiful stores on the backs of the people? And as you said, jobs, you can't forget it. The minimum wage jobs that these Harbor Point developers are about to bring to Baltimore, it's ridiculous. We cannot afford housing on what they're going to pay us.
410-319-8888 is the number here. Michael, you're on the air. Welcome.
Yeah, Equity Matters. Again, a rich discussion. And I think you guys are really keying in on a question that we both ask at Equity Matters, but also the People's Institute for Survival and Beyond, who's in Soweto and New Orleans and all. They ask a simple question, and I think both your last caller and the last comment and the healthcare for the homeless friends that we have there teed up, which is, what makes people poor? And opining on the gap between what really makes people poor and what stereotypically we say makes people poor, and how funding follows what we stereotypically say versus what actually creates it. And if we kind of spend some time on thinking about that question and that gap, even when our friends in Congress and other places, you know, create, you know, alternative financing mechanisms that are wonderful and I agree with, and even legislation that they want to have teeth, if we don't have a general understanding of that gap, Then these rightful policy interventions and incentive creations, which the market will not solve, will not never have teeth. But there's a gap there between what we think makes people what people commonly say makes people poor, and what we know that to be the case. So I'd love for your panelists to comment on that.
Thank you so much, Michael. Always good to hear from you. Anybody like to jump in and answer, Michael?
I have a friend who 2.5 years ago had his job outsourced to another country. He lost his job. He was 50 years old, and he had some savings. But by the end of a year and a half, he was basically through his savings, and people were just not willing to hire a 50-year-old man. He had skills, but they weren't interested in his skills. All those types of jobs are going elsewhere. And if he had not had the advantage of having inherited the home from his parents that he was living in, he would be on the street
right.
at that point. You know, now, he had that advantage, and that let him hold on until after 2.5 years he finally got another job. But, you know, he would have been homeless.
I mean, I think that, you know, we've lost all people that make the argument that there's only so much money in, like, Section 8 housing to put people up. But we don't talk about the amount of public housing that we lost in this city, where it was limited in the very beginning to just 17,000 units. Now it's down to 14,000 some units, right? Lower than that, what you're saying, Kevin? Lower than that. And that obviously, I think it's what Russ was saying when he called in, that if people developed, if developers were forced to build X number of houses every time they built a development downtown to become Baltimore City's own version of public housing, mm-hmm. we wouldn't be facing the problem of homelessness in the city after a certain period of time when those places are rehabbed.
Nationally, we've made a deliberate choice to disinvest in housing. We're spending today, Mark, about 40% of what we spent on housing, the Department of Housing and Urban Development, in 1979. There's no question that then localities like Baltimore have fewer resources to wrestle with, end up tearing down their old housing stock because they can't afford to maintain it anymore and not replacing them in equal numbers.
Because we keep forgetting, you know, when all this hullabaloo during Kurt Schmoke's administration was made when they started blowing up public housing because it was – the high-rises were terrible. That's where all the – were gang-infested. You couldn't have them, tear them down. So we blew them up.
Yeah, you blew them up, but then what?
Right.
Everybody's going to go once you tear them down.
In favor of mixed-income communities, that was the trend
but
at
that
the
didn't
time
happen.
And remains. But we didn't build enough mixed-income communities. We had a 98% reduction in single-room occupancy, SRO units that are targeted to single adults, more than a 75% reduction overall in public housing units in Baltimore because of those implosions. To the caller's point, this is rooted in poverty. We have, Mark, we live in a capitalist democracy that's based on competition, and some of the most vulnerable can't compete. Other capitalist democracies have done more to level the playing field by ensuring access to comprehensive health care as a right of citizenship, by investing more in housing that's affordable to low-income people, and by ensuring that wages are sufficient to keep people out of homeless shelters in the streets.
Let me ask a question. This is a theoretical question here. We only have a few minutes before we kind of remember the names. I want you to tell us, Rick, tell us now, Kevin, where people can come on Saturday, would you?
People can go to the Inner Harbor Amphitheater at 5 p.m. on December 21st, the first day of winter, the longest night of the year. There we will gather together as a community. We will light candles to represent each and every person who died without a regular place to
stay. So far, 95 candles will be lit.
That's correct.
And then we'll process from there to the main homeless shelter on Falls Way, and stopping first at City Hall and leaving there flowers with the names of every person we've identified who passed away after experiencing homelessness.
That's a really good qualifying phrase that Lynn just said, that we've identified.
Right.
We need a tomb for the unknown soldier, so to speak. We need something to remember those that we just don't know about. And there are so many people that will not be on this list, unfortunately.
I think that it would be interesting maybe on another day when we have more time to have a discussion about what would Harbor Point look like? What would the East Harbor development look like in downtown Baltimore if you actually had inclusionary housing? Would people of means not buy the houses then? Would they not move into the apartments? What would it mean to have a mixed-income community in neighborhoods like that? Or what plan can be developed? We need to really examine that. Mm-hmm. And I think that we don't. I think another tweet came in. I don't see it yet, but Let me see if I see it.
And I'll tell you, as a developer of affordable housing, GEDCO stands ready to be the partner to build that housing. There's a lot of feet on the ground ready to make it happen.
So there are, and I think we have to, and I want to thank all of you for being here today, and this is important.
Thank you for doing this show and focusing community attention to it, Mark.
Kevin Lindemuth, that's that you just heard, President and CEO of Healthcare for the Homeless, Lynn Romano, COO of Govan's Ecumenical Development Corporation, Tony Simmons, housing advocate, a writer for Word on the Street, and the Reverend Dennis Dortch, retired United Methodist minister. Good to have all of you in the studio.
Thank you, Mark.
Thank you.
I think that now it's time to kind of memorialize, remember those who left us, that Homeless People with Persons Memorial Day this Saturday, December the 21st, 2013. The following people died in 2013, and their life lacked a stable place to call home. Some died of chronic illness or acute conditions not treated in time. Some died on the streets while staying in an emergency or transitional shelter. Some spent the last few months of their lives in their own apartments. Some were able to reconnect with family and friends before they died, but most died alone, and but for a few, forgotten. We remember them here. Imad Ajoub, Ricky Archie, Wanda Bauer, Benjamin Bell, Patricia Ann Bennett, Ernest Black, William Blackwell, Joseph Blake, Dana Bolden, Cheryl Bryant, Gail Burnett, Shirley Burton, Anthony Carroll, Latricia Chase, Casey Cole, Mark Conley, Joseph Culpepper, Farris Cunningham, Merv Douglas, Jeffrey Emery, Willie English, Rodney Epps, Debbie Evans, Andre Farmer, James Fitzgerald, Yvette Gardner, Gloria Garner, Kevin Gibson, Richard Goldblatt, Blessed Unique, Veronica Goodman, James Green, Mark Gunther, Renee Hansford, Brian Harris, Anthony Hawes, Joan Hulan, Kenneth Hickernell, Ernest Higgins, William Hurst, Antoine Johnson, Sonia Johnson, Van Johnson, Consuela C.J. Jones, William Kinsey, Gregory Lassiter, James Lawson, Sonia LeBlanc, Teresa Lee, Disney Lyles, Walter Mann, Carlos McLean, Edward McDowell, Shaniqua McKethan, Curtis McLaughlin, Joe Meese, Regina Mills, Pacina Mias, Brett Moore, Carlos Ocello, Brian Page, Mark Powley, Karen Payton, Earl Paree, Paul Pretis, James Ramson, Albert Reitler, Kenneth Graytop Roberts, Anthony Rogers, Jeremy Rourke, Christopher Rovnan, Madeline Sander, Cheryl Scharf, Shalonda Scott, Jerome Serio, Myron Shannon, Julian Sharp, Melvin Sizemore, Robert Sowell, Bronislaw Suzorik, Bernard Summers, Eli Supanik, Jim Tankersley, James Teeter, Michael Edward Thomas, Ronald Thomas, Will Marino Torres, Danny Walcott, Reginald Warren, James Watkins, Charles Wyman, Wanda Wiles, Brenda Worsley, Sherman Yarborough, Mamie Young, Ellis Zuckerman, and Carl Lewis and Alva Simpson, who died last year but are remembered here today. On December 21st, the National Homeless Persons Memorial Day, the first day of winter, and the longest night of the year, we remember Mother Joan's words, pray for the dead and fight like hell for the living. We recognize that the lives of the people listed here mattered and had meaning. We recommit ourselves to providing the services and promoting the social change necessary to prevent and end homelessness, and to the pursuit of a future in which health care is available and a right, housing is affordable and accessible, and incomes are livable for all. Remember all those who died because of homelessness in Baltimore today here on the Mark Steiner Show. Join us this Saturday at the Inner Harbor Amphitheater at 5 p.m. The names will be read, candles will be lit.
Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven.